You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And today, this week, we're joined by Orla Shinawy.
Hello, boys.
Hello, Orla.
That's weird. Hello, gentlemen.
We're not offended. That's fine.
We are gentlemen,
sorry,
aren't
gentlemen.
We, Lionel?
Yes, hello, gentlemen. Mm.
Our other gentleman, Daniel Freib, is in the desert.
A laddie in the desert.
Our Daniel in the desert. He's at the Dubai Tour. We'll be hearing from him a little bit later in the episode, and we'll get a full report from Dubai in next week's podcast. But we've got a lot to cover. We're just being joined by Orla for a little bit here. She's got to dash off, but we were recording the latest cycling podcast, Femina, this morning. That will be out soon. Orla is also just back from the Isle of Man, where you went to interview Mark Cavendish and to do a friend special for us on the Isle of Man.
Yeah.
Your first time.
It was my first time in the Isle of Man, which is terrible, given that I grew up about 100 miles away as a crow flies. And I used to sail past it a lot when we went from Belfast to Liverpool on our way down to France for a little road trip holidays as a child. And I used to get very excited when I saw the Isle of Man. I'd like wave, thinking we'd arrived in Liverpool and we hadn't. We'd sail on by. But yeah, that was my first time there. And it was really, really wonderful. Very interesting. I was doing a little bit about the history of cycling in the Isle of Man and the culture of it and where their strength has come from. So, I was hanging out with Mark Cavendish a little bit. He introduced me to quite a few people, including Andrew Roach, their 7-time Commonwealth Games representative. He's now coaching the Commonwealth Games team. I met some of the Commonwealth Games squad themselves. Anna Christian, Dot, who runs their Tuesday night kids club in Douglas, which is now attended by about 300 kids every Tuesday. It's phenomenal. But yeah, it was really, really interesting. It was brilliant. What I really loved about it was seeing Mark Cavendish in that kind of an environment, because from following him from the outside, you think he's always in these glamorous locations, which he often is, and living the high life. But in the Isle of Man, he lives just down the road from his mum. He turns up to the club run of a Tuesday morning, a Wednesday morning, I think it is, where they all just turn up to the National Sports Centre at 9:15 in the morning for a rollout at 9:25. And it's anyone who cares to ride in the island at that given time. So yeah, it was really interesting. It was brilliant.
So that's coming out very soon, your friend special. And it does cover that whole incredible story of Isle of Man cycling. You didn't see friend of the podcast, Peter Kenyuk, while you were there.
I didn't. Annoyingly. Look at the two of you.
If you enemy of the podcast.
Oh, don't do that.
He just refused to do an interview for podcast, didn't he?
Policy.
That's it. Blanket
I think it's a
ban on podcasts.
I would,
fair
if
enough.
I was him. I wouldn't give you an interview.
Really?
Yeah. I'm only here because I have to be. Joking. I've offended you both. I was joking. No, he actually turned up on the Isle of Man as I was there. I think I learned from Instagram and whatnot, and he turned up late. He was late for the Wednesday morning ride, so he didn't make it. And then I ran out of time. I had less than 24 hours on the island, so I wasn't even able to get in touch with him to see if he could chat to me.
So that, yeah, that'll be our fourth Friends of the Podcast offering for 2018. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com to receive our friends specials. Lots more to come. Where are we, Lionel?
We're in your garden office, Richard. Have we recorded in here before? We have, haven't we? Mm. Last year at some point.
Yeah, I only ask you that because a few people complained that I've not been asking you, where are we, Lionel?
Well, yeah, I mean, standards have slipped, haven't they, over the winter. We had a couple of weeks off over Christmas and it's all gone to pot.
News roundup, please, Lionel.
Well, Orla mentioned glamorous locations. Did it get any more glamorous than Dubai? I mean, think of the watches you can buy out there. It's just wall-to-wall class. Oh dear, that was supposed to be a joke.
You think Daniel's going to come back with an arm full of watches?
Yeah. Wouldn't
surprise me.
Inside his coat pocket.
I'm
trying to sell them to you next time.
A suitcase full of watches to sell at the
Del Boy Daniel.
Yeah.
News roundup, please, Lionel.
Well, it doesn't get any more glamorous than Dubai. And Mark Cavendish won there today. The race is midway through, and the sprinters are sharing everything out nicely, playing like good children out there. Dylan Groenewegen won the first stage, Elia Viviani won the second, and Mark Cavendish won the third. So basically, it's a bit like going to a children's birthday party. Everyone gets a prize.
Apart from Marcel Kettel so far. He's going to take the football and go home soon.
Marcel didn't play very nicely on the trampoline, so he's not getting a stage win
this
year.
It's too big, he broke it.
Oh dear.
Left a hole on the trampoline.
I wouldn't like to share a trampoline with Marcel Kittel. You'd end up down the cracks, wouldn't you? Down by the springs.
Caleb Ewan and Marcel Kittel on the same trampoline.
Caleb would be rocketed into space, never to be seen again.
Oh my word. Oh dear. Do you think people can tell we're recording this after lunch?
Two deck hooks. Oh.
Well, that's a big race at the moment. There's been lots of racing elsewhere. Esteban Chavez of, crumbs, Mitchelton Scott. He won the Herald Sun Tour down under. Tony Gallopin galloped to victory in the Étoile de Bessèges. Oh, you can't see Richard's facial expression at that pun. Sorry, everyone. And Alejandro Valverde back in action. He did ride a couple of days or 3 days of the Challenge Mallorca at the end of last month, but he's back in. He's winning again. He's won the Volta Valenciana in sort of, what is that? That's eastern Spain, isn't it? Some halfway down.
Yeah, it's
halfway down.
Round by Valencia.
Yeah, there we are. Alejandro Valverde. He's 38 in April, I think. He had that really terrible crash in the opening time trial of the Tour de France in Dusseldorf in early July. Hadn't raced until the comeback at the Challenge Mallorca. And back to where he has always been, winning Spanish stage races. Another rider doing quite a bit of winning, Fernando Gaviria. He's in Colombia at the moment, racing on home soil, and he's won the opening two stages of the Oro y Paz, the Colombian stage race. Not... What does that mean? Gold and...
Peace.
Gold and peace. Mm. There we are. Lovely. So that is the racing news, Richard. Anyone wants to catch up on the World Cyclocross Championships, there are three episodes from Valkenburg to go back and listen to. I won't tell you who won those races. It's all in there.
That's quite a big omission from your new journal. But fair enough, because you did produce these three episodes while you were there. I didn't see a single pedal stroke of the Cyclocross World Championships, but I did listen to all the podcasts. I really enjoyed it because I'm not a cyclocross aficionado, and for me, actually listening to you describe it was more enjoyable than watching something that I don't really understand, if I'm honest. Mm. And it's funny, isn't it? Because there are people who really do understand it and follow it very, very closely indeed. And this is our first real foray into cyclocross, and a lot of very interesting feedback, some very positive feedback, but some people have very fixed, firm ideas about, you know, what you should cover and what you shouldn't cover. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that is fair to say, and that's fine. But I think we took the cycling podcast type of approach to cyclocross. We weren't there to kind of tick boxes and mention, give everybody a mention. We were there to kind of capture a bit of the flavour of it and sort of talk to some of the people who won races and some of the people who didn't win races. But I think we've never really been a kind of a, we're not like a newspaper of record, are we, where we sort of run through the top 10 and go from race to race in that fashion. We're kind of trying to capture a bit of the atmosphere and a bit of the soundscape. Hopefully did that. You mentioned about not being able to watch it. Well, that was because Eurosport, who had the rights, chose not to show it live. They showed some highlights on Monday night, which I think were also shown on Tuesday. Have to say that, had I realised that before I went, and that might have changed our business decision about investing in covering something that people can actually watch. But hopefully people listened to the podcast and enjoyed what we produced from there.
I know I'm biased in that I'm obviously... favourable towards the cycling podcast in general, but what I really loved about it was, I'm not a cyclocross expert by any means, I think the fact that you couldn't watch it but you could listen to it is almost part of the beauty of cyclocross, because you got a real flavour for that atmosphere, and that to me is what cyclocross, what I imagine it to be in my head, is just a lot of very crazy, quite drunk Europeans going a little bit bonkers over this crazy muddy sport. And I really loved listening to that in a way that you probably wouldn't be able to see on television quite so much because you're busy watching the racing. Whereas it feels to me like it's as much about the atmosphere as it is the action itself.
Yeah, it's a bit like track racing in that aspect, in that you've got a captive audience there at the venue, and there's a real... the crowd are participating in the event. They are as important to it in a way that perhaps only really... You know, when you see the classics or the big mountain stages, you get a little bit of that in road cycling. But the cyclocross, you know, it's a, the courses are designed, particularly that one in Valkenburg, designed to kind of give the crowd a really close look of the riders. There was one section in the middle of the park where it just went back and forth, back and forth. So you could stand in one spot and see them pretty much unbroken for sort of 5 or 6 minutes. People are probably screaming now thinking, well, who won the flaming races? So I will just mention Sanne Kant won the women's elite race for Belgium. And Wout van Aert won the men's race, third title in a row for him, and he beat the hot favourite Matthew van der Poel, who had a bit of a shocker. But hear all about that in the 3 episodes we produced from the weekend.
And we should say a big thank you to the colleagues who joined you for the inaugural podcast, Cyclocross podcast, Renat Schott and Ballant Hanvas.
Yes, thank you.
Very grateful. Yeah. Very grateful to them. And hopefully it's something that we can do again next year in a extended form. We hope. Fingers crossed. Anyway, back to the desert. Daniel is there. We will hear from him. But as you say, Lionel, honours shared so far. But Marcel Kittel. Now, I have a theory about Marcel Kittel because he's looked a bit out of sorts. He's in a new team, obviously. Twice now he's linked up with Alpecin, the sponsor. You know, he's a shampoo manufacturer's dream, isn't he? But Alpecin have twice backed a team that he's been part of. And the last time that happened, when the Giant Alpecin became Giant Alpecin, he had an absolute shocker of a season. Virtually missed the season. He was ill and unwell and never found any form.
Any correlation here? Is this some kind of Samson?
Then he moved teams to Quickstep and rediscovered his mojo. Now he's moved to Katusha, who are Katusha Alpecin or Alpecin Katusha. And are they Katusha Alpecin? I think Katusha Alpecin.
Yeah. I think.
And well, I mean, the season's only 3 days old.
Oh, I was going to say that's probably.
I don't want to write him off.
And
he was close today. He was close today. A good lead out today. Very, very committed.
He was Katusha. Third, wasn't he?
He was third today.
Not a million miles off.
Not a million miles off. Katusha, very committed. It's very rare though that Mark Cavendish has beaten Kittel in a straight sprint like that. The tour last year, 2016. But it's not happened very often. And it just strikes me, it is early doors, a lot of people in new teams finding their feet. And they have been pretty chaotic. Cavendish spoke about how dangerous Stage 2 was.
And Stage 1.
But Stage 1, in fact, he was talking about. At this point in the season, there are so many, you know, new teams who will really fancy themselves as sprint trains and so on. And there's just so much that's unknown, and there's very little to tell between a lot of these riders and teams now, that there's no order. It's just anarchy. And so we haven't seen any crashes or any serious crashes in the finales, but it doesn't look... There's no pecking order, really, is there, at the moment? And that's partly explained by the sharing of the stage wins. But it's an interesting part of the season from that point of view.
Which makes it wide open, which is always really good. I think it's... Sprint races anyway, if you've got stage after stage of sprinting, can be a little bit dull. At least if you've got different winners, it spices it up a little bit. And I think, you know, saying that, yeah, fair enough, Kittel, no wins yet this season. But to reference even the fact that it's been quite a while since Cavendish would have beaten him in a man-on-man sprint, I think made it quite interesting for the season ahead, because Cavendish, with so much to prove after last season, so much disappointment, his worst season to date, you could tell how much that win today meant to him. It was almost relief as much as joy when he crossed that line.
How did you feel when you spoke to him last week, Orla? How did you feel his mind was in terms of how's his winter gone? What's his fitness like? What were his feelings ahead of the season?
Well, it was difficult to tell in a way, because he certainly seemed like he was confident about the season ahead. Definitely you know, very much up for it. It was a different kind of Mark Cavendish that I saw, though. But I'm not sure if that's because we were on the Isle of Man and I've never seen him there before. We're used to a Mark Cavendish that's very cocky, really, and very, very confident. Seeing him, you know, I saw him with his mum and I saw him with all the guys he usually trains with. People have known him, you know, like Dot Tilbury, like I say, who's known him since he was a boy. So it was a very different kind of Mark Cavendish, but I think that's probably more because he was back home and he was amongst, you know, his own rather than any indication of the season ahead. But he certainly seemed very happy. He seemed in a good place. He's been training incredibly hard and he thinks that it's going well. And he's hungry for the season ahead, certainly after last year. I think it was great. I thought it was great to see him win today anyway.
Well, he's matched his tally of wins from 2017 already. Yeah, he won one race last year, a stage of the Abu Dhabi Tour. So he's sprinting is more than any other discipline. It all hinges on winning. And, you know, get one, then it's easier to get the second and third and so on. I mean, that's how they work, isn't it? And just talking about how I was being very flippant, saying that they're sharing the wins around like a children's birthday party, but this is far more interesting to watch than the years gone by when, say, Tom Bonham would win four or five even stages in the Tour of Qatar, and you'd think, well, that was just a benefit race for one rider. Here we are seeing, you know, the beginning of a sort out to decide who the pecking order is. But again, these races really, in the grand scheme of things, you know, when it comes to the Tour de France and the big sprints, that these wins are just, a minor.
Are they though? I mean, maybe that's more the case now. But in the past, there has emerged a dominant team, you know, generally in sprinting. It hasn't remained like that all year. There has been a dominant team. And once teams start to find themselves boxed out in finishes and so on, it can be very hard to reassert yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think this phase of the season is really important for establishing a pecking order and for certain teams and certain riders. And I think that's why, although, you know, it is only 3 days into the season and it's too early to dismiss Kittel, he will feel the pressure. You know, he will feel, especially in a new team, that it's important that he, because the lead out will only be as effective as he is effective as a sprinter. It's a complicated sort of equation, but the more confident they are in him, the better they will be. And he obviously needs them to be good in order to win.
Especially as Quick-Step flaws are already off to a flyer with a new rider, Elia Viviani, who you would not have put on the same shelf as Kittel before now. But he's slotted in there and he's clearly doing better already than he was doing with Sky. And if you were looking at Quick-Step and thinking, well, Gaviria is already off the mark, not just here, but also in Argentina, Colombia and Argentina. Yes, I know these are small races and, you know, it's not the same. But, you know, they've got another engine to put onto the front of that sprint train, you know, when the big races come round. And I think Kittel would probably look at Quick-Step and think, yeah, I know exactly what they can do. And I'm not on the front. I'm not on the back of that. I've got to get my guys into shape. And it will take a little bit of a while for them, I'm sure.
But we're also saying hi. It's important for teams to show their dominance, sprint teams to show their dominance and get the lead out sorted. But I mean, we see that the lead out trains either don't work the same as they used to, or maybe they're not as important as they used to be. But certainly Cavendish today, I think maybe Bernie Eisel was up ahead, but Cavendish certainly wasn't on his wheel. I mean, we know that he can win without the benefit of a lead out anyway. But more often than not, I think sprinters these days are winning despite the breakdown of a lead out rather than thanks to, and obviously it's the team's dominance throughout the whole stage and keeping them protected, not just, you know, in the run up to the line. But
depends on the sprint as well, doesn't it? I think Kittel needs clear road in front of him, and I think he's one of those guys who does benefit from a good lead out where he doesn't have to go around people. I mean, Cavendish is so good at, you know, going around people and finding spaces and so on. Kittel's bigger and just more, his sprint is based on more sheer power, I guess.
Well, will he suffer then with respect to what Cavendish was talking about, certainly on stage one, whereby he was referencing a rule change that the UCI made over the winter, whereby riders maybe not penalised so much for crossing the peloton. You know, are we going to see more of that and less of a clear road in front? I mean, that could certainly hamper Kittel if that's going to be the case.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
We interrupt the podcast to bring you news of Lisa Mattresses, who are sponsoring this week's episode, and in a moment we'll give you details about how you can get a fantastic discount. But Lionel, you and I have taken delivery of our new Lisa mattress. They are available only online and come to your door compressed in a box, in a very, very small box.
Yeah, you do have to be a little careful when you open the box and the mattress comes out and expands to full size. But it's taken all of that self-consciousness out of bed buying. No opportunity to go and bounce on the mattress in the store. Just get it delivered to the door. It's a bit Team Sky, though, this, isn't it? Having a mattress delivered. Team Sky famously take mattresses around the Grand Tours. I did try and squeeze the Lisa mattress back into its box to see whether I could take it to the Giro, but unfortunately not. It's just not going to go back in that box.
I wonder if they'd do that. They'll deliver us a fresh new mattress to every Premier Class, Formula One and other salubrious hotels that we stay in at the Tour de France.
That might be pushing it a bit, but jokes aside, going on the Grand Tours, and particularly in France, where they still seem to love the sausage-shaped pillow and the sort of spongy, springy mattress, it can really affect your recovery at the end of a hard day's covering the Tour de France and a big dinner, can't it? But the Lisa mattress, I have to say, is extremely comfortable.
Is it the mattress that's spongy, Lionel, or is it you? That's what I want to know. But you're right, it is extremely comfortable. Lisa will give you 100 nights to try your mattress at home, and if you're not sleeping better within 100 nights, they will come and get it to donate or recycle, and you'll also get a full refund.
We should add that this is a company that gives a lot back. For every 10 mattresses sold, they donate one to charity. They give custom-made mattresses to organisations that serve homeless and at-risk men, women and children. On their website, you'll see more details about this as well as some case studies.
So to the exclusive offer, you can receive £80 off a Lisa mattress with the code CYCLING. Go to lisa.co.uk, that's Lisa, L-E-E-S-A, L-E-E-S-A. And enter the code CYCLING to receive £80 off your Lisa mattress, which is a fantastic offer. Thank you again to Lisa Mattress for their support of the Cycling Podcast. The Lisa Mattress, a better place to sleep.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Yes, thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport, one of our sponsors here at the Cycling Podcast again this year. Very grateful indeed to them for their support. They're also offering you, the listener, 25% off all their products at scienceandsport.com. Just enter the code SISCP25 at the checkout. That is available to UK listeners. Very generous 25% off. And we had an email actually from an Alex Toghill, who is one of 8 police officers cycling from New Scotland Yard to Monte Carlo in May to raise money for a couple of charities. They'll be taking on Mont Ventoux during that ride. He was wondering what the optimum amount of Science and Sport product was for that length of ride, 1,800 kilometres. We'll put that to Science and Sport. We're encouraging as many of you as possible to send in your questions for Science and Sport's experts. We'll be putting those to them very soon and playing some of their answers in future podcasts. Email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And if you want to support the police officers on their ride, he also asked Lionel, he asks a few questions about advice about conventional sort of meal eating as well. You're the expert. French breakfasts are nothing but cold meats and skinny breadsticks. So apart from a short lunch stop and evening meals, any recommendations from Lionel would be much appreciated. We would be heavily reliant on SIS fueling during the ride. So if you want to support the police officers who are taking part in this ride of 1,800 kilometres, go to the Just Giving page. They are raising money for Stop the Traffic. That is the charity working to prevent human trafficking and modern slavery around the world. And you'll find their Just Giving page at justgiving.com/met2med. Met to Med, get it?
Almost up there with my Tony Gallopin
almost
tweet from earlier.
Almost.
Tweet, pun. not everything you say is a tweet, is it?
Depends who you're talking to. We've had to say cheerio to Orla. She's had to dash off. But it was nice to have her for part one. And the Cycling Podcast Femina that we recorded with Rose Manley for company this month will be out very soon. We should mention our forthcoming book tour as well. We are doing how many?
Seven events.
Seven events, starting in Salford on the 28th of February, Edinburgh on the 1st of March, Glasgow on the 2nd of March, Nottingham on the 7th of March, London on the 8th of March, Leeds on the 9th, and Sheffield on the 10th. And tickets are selling extremely well. There are tickets left for just about all those events. I think a couple are very close to selling out. So do go to thecyclingpodcast.com for more information and for links to buy tickets.
Yeah, if you go to thecyclingpodcast.com and click on the tab on the left-hand side, or it might be in the top right, depending on whether you're looking on a phone or on a browser, but there's a menu bar, and click on live events, and there's a piece there explains a little bit of background about the book, which you can order with your tickets if you want, and get a discount on the price of the book if you buy with an event ticket and collect your book on the night.
That's important to say, actually, isn't it? Because it can look a bit confusing. There are two, the tickets are, for most of the venues, appear to be two different prices. The higher price includes a book, and that should be stressed. We'll be signing books on the night as well.
Yeah, so get a copy of A Journey Through the Cycling Year, our first book as the Cycling Podcast, and it was a lot of fun too. It's certainly something different to anything that I've done before, a different style of book, kind of a flavour of the podcast, a reportage, and a few stories that we couldn't tell on the podcast, but we have put into print. Hopefully it will be well received.
It does. It's interesting. We all started off writing, didn't we? And it was fascinating to go back and almost look at how you translate the style of the podcast back into the written word in a way, and a lot of it is the three of us, me, myself, you, Lionel, and Daniel, kept diaries at the grand tours, and our diaries are there. And yeah, as you say, they're the sorts of stories that might appear in the podcast that maybe didn't, or some other angle on the race and on the journey around the race. And it was a lot of fun, and that is out on the 1st of March. It costs £16, I believe. Also chapters in there by Joe Dombrowski, Ashley Mulman-Passio, and friends of the podcast, Ciro Scognamiglio, Francois Tomaso, Orla, Fran Reyes, and Seb Piquet. So a lot of fun to put together, and hope you enjoy it when it comes out. We'll be signing copies of the book at these events that we're doing. Now, before we're gonna look ahead to some of the upcoming races in part three, but before then, we were going to cross over to the desert, and Daniel, who's out there all week, and he'll, as I said earlier, he'll report back more fully next week. But he sat down with Alexander Christoph after the third stage. Here he is now, Daniel Freib.
Hello, chaps, and good evening from a very noisy, very lively Dubai. Hope things are well there. Yeah, it's very lively here. Thursday's a big night for going out in Dubai. I'm not going out. I'm not mixing with the revelers. I've got work to do. We decided, you guys and I decided that we weren't going to talk too much about the actual race, Dubai, this week, because it's not over yet, and that would involve probably some degree of speculation. But you know, rest assured, I've been collecting plenty of material, some real gems that I'm going to bring back from the Persian Gulf. As a bit of a teaser, I'm actually standing right outside the very fancy hotel where all of the World Tour riders are housed this week. And inside waiting for me is Alexander Christoph, the Norwegian sprinter, classics rider, just signed for the UAE team. Not had the best start to the week in Dubai. He's not managed to bring home any victories, but I'm just going to go and have a quick chat with him, and as I say, give you a bit of an amuse-bouche of what is to come in next week's pod, hopefully, when I'm back.
Yeah, in Sanremo I was doing as good as I can. I know I'm not strong enough to attack in Poggio, so for me it's more than hard enough every year to stay in Poggio, so there I actually performed as good as I could. So if it come together there, maybe I would have won, but yeah, they hold off with a few seconds. But in Flanders, I felt not strong enough. I was there in the same group like Gilbert that attacked on the Mur, but I had not the same gear up Quarmont when he went. So actually, I was not good enough to win it. But when I won in 2015, I was going a little bit better, for sure. you could see that also I had some extra, that I had the energy to follow. And I hope I can get this again. But I know I must really have a nice run in, and I must really find the shape and be a bit lucky also to come in the same position. But everything is possible. I didn't feel really, like, for example, in Tour de France, we didn't really drag in the same direction, and they were more about showing the jersey and not about trying to win the stage. So we had guys for every stage and not really focusing on the sprints, because they said before the season we're going to focus just for the sprints. But at the end we did not. So yeah, I was a little bit disappointed about that. And yeah, but at the end we finished off good, because we were serious both ways, all the way to the last race, and I tried to perform my best, and they did their best to help me perform. So we left in a good mood, and maybe you never know. You know, it's always good to have friends in the peloton, and yeah, I still have a good relationship with the guys that is here now. So that's at least nice.
In the first few days you spent with this team, your new team, Alexander. Were there any things, and can you give any examples of things that made you go, wow, that's different, and that's, you know, really different from Katusha?
I think more or less the pro teams work for sure a little bit in the same way, so I don't really feel, wow, this is totally different. But there is always small differences, like when we are here now, it's the first race, and for sure we have way more stuff going on before the race, because we are in home country, you know, from the sponsors. So when I was here, or did the Tour Qatar, for example, before with Katusha, we had very relaxed. So I was a bit surprised we come here and we had to do training rides with sponsors and go to school and say hi to kids. And yeah, it was a busy program a few days, but I think it's a little bit special for this race. So maybe come back to normal later in the season. But yeah, it's also small differences for sure, equipment-wise and this, but the way the things are running, not really so much difference. But it reminds me a bit when I was the first year in Katusha, because then we also had the service course in Italy and a lot of Italian stuff. So it reminds a bit of the first year for me in Katusha.
And is that image still accurate, that you're that image of you doing, you know, 5-6 hours, 7 hours maybe in -10 or whatever?
I don't do 7 hours in -10 now, but I do sometimes 7 hours for sure. That's still accurate. Actually, also in Norway 20 years ago was not a big sport, and now it's very big. So, and mostly it's because of big riders, and now UAE have their own team, so for sure that will generate some sort for attention, and that they have some team to cheer for. And we have also Mirza, which is from the country. He's riding for us, and he's actually quite good rider. So yeah, if he can be an idol for the younger kids, that it's possible to be a pro rider also from UAE, then maybe in a few years they can get some more.
Alexander, if you had to choose between winning San Remo again and Flanders again, which would you choose?
Ah, that's a hard choice, but I feel the Flanders win was harder to achieve. I think it's more likely that I win San Remo, but I was, I don't know, every year top five in the Flanders, so I don't know, but I feel I'm closer every year to win San Remo, but yeah, I was never feeling I was that close to win Flanders, except the year I won it. And the other years I won the sprint in the second group, but there was still quite a long way to the win. So I think it's a bigger chance in San Remo, but yeah, the Flanders one is maybe hangs a bit higher.
Well, we talked to Cavendish last night, and he says, bizarrely for him, since Limagne has not been on the course, it's become harder for him because it's a faster race. But I think you used to really dislike Limagne, is that right? And you much prefer it without Limagne.
Yeah, I don't know. I only did it one time with it. Okay. And actually, I made the climb, but I didn't make the downhill. And so I was the last position on the top. And in the downhill, suddenly it broke in three pieces, and I never saw the front again. So I don't have good memories from the climb, so I rather just see we skip it.
And in your team this year, you've got another rider who's got a very good record in San Remo, not as good as yours, but Ben Swift. What role is he going to have in San Remo, if any?
I think he will have a little bit open role, because he's usually climbing a bit better than me. And like last year, it was a break going away, and if we have Ben there, he's a good guy to can finish this off. So then we have a good car to play, and if it's not, he will do a lead out for me. So he has a car there to join the attackers, and if he don't make it, he must help me at the end, I think. Yeah, I don't really like cobbles that much, so I don't know.
I don't understand. you go for the cobbles in Flanders and not in Roubaix.
Yeah, it's uphill cobbles is okay. With the flat ones, I even struggle in Flanders.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you to our headline sponsor, Rafa. We're very proud to be backed by Rafa for a, what would you say, third year?
I suppose so.
Even though they haven't actually sponsored us yet for 2 years, it is our third year of being sponsored by Rafa.
They came on board for the 2016 Tour de France, carried on from there.
They did. And we are very, very grateful to them because they enable us to produce these weekly episodes and daily from the Grand Tours, which we'll be doing again this year. Well, it's not far away, is it, the Giro?
No.
I was booking Tour de France accommodation the last few days.
I know. I've been looking at some of the places you
found. Look
at
the spreadsheets, yeah.
Yeah, adding up the budget, making sure we're not over budget again like we were last year.
You know, I thought someone had better do it at some point. The accommodation wasn't going to book itself, was it?
It wasn't, no. But, you know, I was away working at the weekend, Richard, at the Cyclocross podcast. I mean, even Daniel's got off the mark before you. What are you doing?
Daniel does the booking for the Giro, doesn't he? That's his thing.
He does, and he prioritises places that are ideally suited for his morning run. I think that's the criteria.
That would appear so, yeah.
Mm. Is that him barking?
I don't know if you're hearing that. The neighbour's dog is currently barking.
But I was trying to shame you there, Richard. You've not started work yet this year. I mean, I made my seasonal debut at the Cyclocross World Championships. Daniel off the mark at the Dubai Tour. Even Orla's been off to the Isle of Man.
Orla.
Well, what are you doing?
Sorry, I thought you meant for us. Yeah, I missed a lot. I mean, Orla's been working hardest of all of us because she's actually got a job. But Orla's been off to the Isle of Man. I'm preparing, actually, Lionel, to go off on an extended overseas trip. I leave for Spain on Monday for the Ruta del Sol. I thought a nice quiet start to the year at the Ruta del Sol. You know, it's a very low-key race,
not
very
much
relaxed.
Going on there.
And, you know, access to riders is very easy because there are very few journalists around. So I thought, if I'm going to start my season, I want to just, you know, ease myself in. And I thought Ruta del Sol would be perfect for that.
Well, there's not going to be many stories to cover there, is there? What with Chris Froome making a controversial seasonal debut?
I'm joking, of course. And we did exclusively reveal on the podcast a couple of weeks ago that Chris Froome would open his season at the Ruta del Sol.
We get a lot of criticism for your hopeless transfer speculation over the years, but not the odd occasion
when I'm right about something.
Yeah, the equivalent praise for scooping everyone on that.
it was just a hunch.
It was a well tipped off hunch.
Yeah, it was a bit of a hunch, but Chris Froome is starting his season at the Ruta del Sol, and that will mean that the Ruta del Sol is not quite as low key as it usually is. There will be a big media presence there and obviously a big crowd around the Team Sky bus. The Ruta del Sol organisers are obviously delighted that Chris Froome is riding and that, you know, lots of people will be paying a lot of attention to their race. But it is controversial because Froome has his adverse analytical finding for salbutamol still unresolved and no signs really yet of when it will be resolved. It's a long, drawn-out game. Inner Ring, the brilliant blog that he blogs every day, usually something very interesting, well informed, did one on Chris Froome the other day and the Chris Froome case, and there has been a lot of calls for Froome to self-suspend or for Team Sky to suspend him or for the UCI to suspend him, and none of these calls necessarily are paying all that much attention to the actual rules of the case, and a lot of comparisons with the Alberto Contador case for clenbuterol a few years ago. It's quite different because clenbuterol is a banned substance. Salbutamol is a controlled substance. And this was something I didn't really fully appreciate. But with Contador, when he raced on with the case still unresolved, the results that he achieved in that period were subsequently stripped. He was stripped of them. That included a Giro d'Italia win. With Froome, that will not be the case. He could be banned. He could win the Giro in May and be banned in June, but keep the Giro title. So it's quite a different case, but no less unsatisfactory. Because if you're Chris Froome, you're not going to ban yourself because it's an admission of guilt, and he insists that he's innocent. If you're Team Sky, and you have the well-being of the sport as your primary concern, you probably would sideline him, as they did with Sergio Henao a few years ago. But their job is also to win races, and they're in a difficult situation. Similarly, if they did sideline him and suspend him, that too would look like an admission of guilt or wrongdoing, or an assumption that some crime has been committed that he may subsequently be exonerated of. But it's a very, very, very difficult situation. I think all that we can really hope for is a quick resolution to it.
Yeah, but there doesn't seem to be any sign that there is going to be a quick resolution at the moment, does there? I mean, I do understand people being very frustrated and directing that frustration to the UCI. And I think over the years we've been... we haven't been slow to criticise the UCI when they have, when they maybe dragged their heels or not added or given the leadership or added the clarity that perhaps is required. But in this case, they are themselves also the victims of this leak. I mean, let's not forget that, I mean, I keep saying this, but it is an important thing to remember that had it not been for the information being leaked effectively to two newspapers, The Guardian and Le Monde, we would probably be none the wiser about this. Now, somebody clearly wanted to get that information about Chris Froome out into the public domain, but as we keep saying, and I have asked the UCI, are there other cases? I mean, obviously they're not going to answer whether there are or have been other cases. I mean, but we gather that in this circumstance, the UCI have basically followed the rules perfectly adequately. They are allowed to not suspend Chris Froome. They've allowed Chris Froome the time to explain the presence of elevated levels of salbutamol in the sample, which is the whole problem here. And then Chris Froome needs to demonstrate that he's not broken the actual rule as written, which is not to actually administer more than the permitted amount of salbutamol. So it's a multifaceted and really quite complex case. And while it is very frustrating, and while it is very easy to say, come on, UCI, get on with it, sort this out, there are, from what I gather, there are science and legal experts poring over this. And it's probably unrealistic to expect a speedy resolution, unless that speedy resolution is just to sort of sweep it away and say, oh, no, you know, there's going to be no sanction. That's the only way it could be resolved quickly, as far as I can see. In order to impose a suspension on Chris Froome, I think they would have to go through and do their due diligence on every single aspect of this from a legal point of view. Otherwise, they'd be at risk to an appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport and the risk of having it overturned. And in the big picture, that's an even muckier, murkier, muddier resolution than just leaving it while it's currently open-ended.
And we wonder also how much the timetable now is dictated by the experts and lawyers. I mean, the figures released this week, UK Anti-Doping spent £500,000 on legal fees in their case against Tyson Fury, the boxer. And that's pretty depressing. That's money that could be used on anti-doping and is just used on legal fees concerning one case. And no doubt this case will be just as costly for the UCI. And again, that's money that could be much better spent, you would have thought.
Well, we talk about the sort of the medicalization of sport, if you like, but the legal aspect of it as well. I mean, the UCI is not a wealthy enough body to find itself in a situation where it's having to fight multiple legal cases. I mean, it will be costing them as well.
And well, exactly. And the Floyd Landis case almost bankrupted the UCI, almost ended the anti-doping at the UCI, in fact. So there's a lot at stake, and it's not good at all. Obviously, I'll try and speak to Chris Froome at the Ruta del Sol. I'm not sure how much speaking he'll be doing, but we'll try and get a word with him and find out what's going on and just how much he's in control of the process, because you know, you speak to people at UCI and they tend to suggest that it's the Froome side that's dragging things along, whereas on the Sky side they will say the opposite.
What's really interesting to me is to see how does he race. I mean, if he wins anything there, he's going to put himself right in the spotlight, isn't he? And if you look at the last, what is it, six winners of the Ruta del Sol, going back to 2012, Alejandro Valverde has won five times and Chris Froome won the other one, which was in 2015. And with the Giro being the first big point of his season, you would expect, and given the block of training that we know Chris Froome has done down in South Africa, pretty much ridden a grand tour and a half in training, hasn't he? You would expect him to be wanting to test where his form is.
I think if he's racing, he'll be, you know, he'll be Chris Froome.
You can't imagine it any other way, can you? But that is going to have consequences as well off the bike, because the questions will get louder and the controversy will get bigger the more visible, the more aggressive in the racing he is.
Absolutely. And if I do get to speak to him, that's kind of what I would like to ask him most, how you compartmentalize something like this, how something like this doesn't just affect you at every minute of the day, how it doesn't affect your sleep, never mind your training and your recovery and all the rest of it. I don't know how, you know, I don't know how he does that, but that's something that all these guys have in common, the ability to just put things like this in a box somewhere. And I don't want to compare the two, because that's not really fair, but Alejandro Valverde raced on winning for a few years, while he had the Operation Puerto case hanging over him until he was eventually suspended. You know, he just carried on, and he was exactly the same Valverde he'd always been. He then sat out for a couple of years in his ban, and he came back exactly the same, and he still is.
Amazing, isn't it, really? Incredible.
So I'll go from the Ruta del Sol to Het Nieuwsblad.
Oh, the proper start of the season.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be in Belgium for a bit because I'm doing a few interviews for our forthcoming Friends special, actually, and I'm looking forward to that. But two extremes there, really, and that we've talked about that, haven't we? About the cycling season, kind of it kind of goes along parallel train tracks in a way with the stage racers preparing in sunnier climes in this slightly more relaxed setting usually. And the classics riders in the north of Europe in the bad weather usually, riding completely different races with a completely different atmosphere around them.
Well, Het Nieuwsblad, the traditional opener, it's so far out from the Tour of Flanders. What is it? It's at least 4 weeks before the Tour of Flanders. It does operate kind of on its own. It's more a curtain raiser than a kind of a... It's not quite the sort of the first of those races in a competitive sense, is it? Because we always look back at the results and go, well, if you're too hot at Het Nieuwsblad, maybe that's not great preparation for the Tour of Flanders.
I think that distance allows it its own breathing space. You know, I think winning Het Nieuwsblad is quite a thing for a rider to have anyway.
In its own right. And I think this year, even more so, we talked about it a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, this new finish, or it's a very familiar finish to anyone who watched the Tour of Flanders maybe 6-7 years ago, over the Mur, over the Bosberg, and into Meerbeke, which is a sort of hamlet on the fringes of Ninove. I'm looking forward to seeing that finish again, because I think it's one of those things where the balance of the road and the you know, what the riders can realistically try to do in those final 12, 15 kilometres. I think it's fascinating. What will be interesting is what kind of impact it has after a couple of hundred kilometres rather than after, you know, the Tour of Flanders. It would be after 250 kilometres. Big
it's
difference.
It's always a good race, isn't it? What would you rather win, E3 or Het Nieuwsblad?
Het Nieuwsblad. I know E3 is a bigger race, isn't it, really, now? But I don't know. This Het Nieuwsblad's the one that just captures the imagination. I don't know.
Het Nieuwsblad or Gent-Wevelgem?
Ooh, Het Nieuwsblad still, I think. Yeah.
See, so, yeah, you see, it's kind of, it's got its own status almost.
I mean, these aren't choices I'm going to have to actually make.
But E3 and Gent-Wevelgem tend to be seen more in the context of the Tour of Flanders and the build-up to the Tour of Flanders.
Yeah, but they're very much stepping stones on the way to the big one, aren't
exactly.
they?
Whereas Het Nieuwsblad has got its own prestige, I think, and I'm looking forward to that. Anyway, we should wrap things up there, Lionel. We don't want to go on too long.
Het Nieuwsblad or Paris Camembert?
Het Nieuwsblad.
Yeah, but you think of all the camembert you win at Capari Camembert.
And just retire in a mountain of cheese.
Yeah, you need a massive oven to do a baked camembert with one of their...
Well, I ain't going to know which one you'd rather win. Anyway, we should wrap things up
we
there,
should.
Lionel. Whimsical
today. I'm expecting complaints about
next week. I'll be coming from Spain. Who knows what I'll have. Daniel will be fresh from the desert, and he'll have a package, no doubt, from the Dubai tour. And you'll be in Watford.
Not in Watford, no, but, you know, for the purposes of the joke, yes, I'll be in Watford.
Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast. Buy our exclusive clothing line made by Rafa at rafa.cc or by clicking on shop at cyclingpodcast.com. This episode was edited and produced by Alex Adie.